Welcome to a special episode of The Partial Historians. I am one of your hosts, Dr. Rad.
And I am Dr. G. And we're super excited today because we're joined by Dr. Emma Salmon.
Hello. Hi. I have friends who call me Dr. Nuclear, so...
That explains your Twitter Nuclear handle.
It comes from that. The Twitter handle thing is quite a long and weird story.
For those of you who aren't following Emma Southland on Twitter right now, why the hell not? And also, her Twitter handle is Nuclear Teeth.
Which made sense in the exact moment that I made it and has been a 10-minute explanation ever since.
Well, we won't ask you, but I must admit, I feel very simpatico with you after reading this new book of yours, which is A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. I thought we had things in common before when you chose to write about Agrippina for your first book. But after reading this next book, I've realized that you are, in fact, a murderino who watches Drag Race, and both those things excite me a lot.
I am, and I will get Drag Race into everything. The finale of Drag Race UK was yesterday.
So, I haven't seen it yet. Ooh.
It's so good. Get on it.
Oh, very exciting. All right, so let's flip back to the murderino in you. What attracted you to writing about murder for your second book?
It was a really specific incident, actually, which was the day that the Golden State Killer was caught. And if you're a murder person, then you'll know that, like, the kind of crime, murder, true crime internet just exploded that day and was on fire because this was a case that no one thought would ever get solved. And I was talking to another friend of mine who is a teacher in Georgia in the US, and we were, as part of talking about why the hell we were so excited about this, we're talking about what it is that attracts us to thinking so much about murders that happened in the past before we were born, in places we've never been. And she was saying that she uses talking about true crime as a way to teach her students about various kind of social issues, basically. So it's quite a good way for her. So when she's talking about, for example, the AIDS crisis or homophobia in the 1980s in America, then Jeffrey Dahmer is a really good way of getting them interested in that, because you can talk about why nobody was talking about gay men going missing all the time. And I was like, oh my God, that's so brilliant. I bet someone's written a really good book about murder or crime in the Roman Empire and what it says about, like, Roman cultural attitudes. And after 3 days of looking, I realised that no one had. So I wrote it, basically.
Now, I was very excited to see this because as a podcast addict, I currently subscribe to about 600. It's a very 50-50 split between true crime and history. So I was very excited to see it. And I also love a bit of detective work in the classroom. So now I actually have some cases to use if I ever want to get murdery in the classroom, which sounds really bad, but I mean it in a good way.
Not the kind of murdery where anyone actually dies.
No.
But yeah, but then, and the more I thought about it, like, the reason that I am really interested in true crime and the reason that I listen to about 5 true crime podcasts as well is that you learn so much about the culture in which the crime occurred by its responses to it. Like, what draws a lot of attention, what doesn't draw attention, what is considered to be just a fact of life. Like, sex workers getting murdered, you need about 10 before police will get interested. But here in the UK, we've just had a middle-class white girl get killed, and 20 minutes after she went missing, it was all over everything. And, like, that's how you know what's important in our culture and how you abdicate from being important, which is doing sex work. And so it was really fascinating to look at Rome from that perspective. Who do they think is important and why?
So I think this leads in really nicely to thinking about, like, what constitutes homicide versus murder.
Yeah.
Because these two concepts are often used interchangeably, but maybe shouldn't be.
No, they kind of shouldn't be. Technically, homicide is whenever one person kills another person. But that is all contexts in which somebody is killed. So if it's accidental, in war, in the death penalty, in, you know, any situation whereby one person kills another is homicide. And then murder is the emotive way of defining which ones are bad. So depending on whether you want to see a homicide as bad or not, it depends on whether you call it murder. And that is a legal structure. So you have murder versus manslaughter, whereby intention is the thing that that differentiates those, like I accidentally killed them versus I meant to kill them. But also in kind of everyday speak, you have people who consider, I think the example I eventually possibly kept in or cut out, I can't remember now, is that when WikiLeaks released the tape that got Chelsea Manning into trouble, which was the people being killed in Iraq, they called it collateral murder. And they used a very specific word there in order to say that they think that this is a crime and that they think that this is something that should be punished. And we have a similar thing over here that goes on constantly. I live in Northern Ireland. And like one of the legacies of the Troubles is, what do you do with soldiers during the Troubles who shot civilians? And on the one side, you have people who will argue constantly that we should defend them. They were in war. It's not an act of murder, it is a homicide committed in the course of war. And on the other side, you have people saying they were unarmed civilians, it's murder, and they should be tried for murder. And this goes on constantly. And they're talking about the exact same incident where the exact same person killed the exact same person, but how they define it and whether they use the word murder or not is the only difference, is whether they think it was justified or whether they think it was a bad thing that should be punished. And that's really the only way that we use murder.
So this is really fascinating, because I think you'd probably take it for granted that most civilizations have at the heart of their law code something about the killing of another person, because it seems like a pretty big deal. But what did the Romans have to say about murder in their law code?
For a very long time, nothing. For the entirety of the Republican period, really, up until Sulla, there is nothing about murder. There is some things about intentional homicide, which is where they're really only interested in whether you meant to do it or not. And it's really blurry because we've only got like extracts of bits in Cicero, and then they're not, like when you get down to the Justinian period, like they weren't the bits that got kept, basically, which suggests that they weren't particularly relevant by the time you get to the 6th century. But there's something in there about intentional homicide, which is where they spend a lot of time discussing whether it's intentional or not. But until you get to Sulla, the idea that the state should be interested in whether people were killing each other or not is just doesn't really seem to exist, except in really specific circumstances where they would convene a special court for it. But there doesn't seem to be a specific law that they were referring to. Until you get to Sulla, who are obviously trying to rebuild the Republic in his own image. And after the social wars and his wars, everything was in chaos and the courts had fallen into a situation where people seem to spend their time bribing jurors and bribing one another to give their enemies the death penalty. So he made that murder. You no longer were allowed to bribe somebody. And he bribed somebody to give your enemy the death penalty, which is such a weirdly specific way of killing someone, or carry knives with the intention of killing people, or poison them. And like those three things suddenly became murder, basically. Like something that the state considered to be bad enough that they had to write a law about it. It gives the impression that that period of Rome, like 80 BC, is a time when people are just dying in the streets constantly. And it probably was absolute chaos. But he's the first person who really says, stop killing each other. And this is my business now. And before that, it was just something that the legal structures of Rome weren't interested in.
And I think this sort of throws the whole fratricide that sort of sits at the really the foundation point of Rome into a really interesting perspective, because it seems like it may have been the case that the Romans weren't really considering that to be such a bad thing in the way that we would.
No.
But perhaps in a different way.
They Because what Remus does is he breaches the walls of Rome. And if you breach the walls of Rome, you deserve to die. Like, there's no real sense that they condemn Romulus in any way for that. And it's interesting that when you look at the way that Romans tell their stories about themselves, like when they're sitting in the first century and they all decide to write their own history over again, basically, how many murders there are at the center of all of the most defining stories, like Romulus and Remus, and then like Lucretia having to kill herself so that the Republic can rise. And then, you know, there are a surprising amount of really bloody incidents at the court, which, so it's unsurprising that by the time you get to like the turn from the Republic into the imperial system, that it happens around a murder, Julius Caesar. Like, that's the central point, largely because they had spent 100 years all murdering each other constantly. And there's when I started talking about Republican murders, like political murders, I had a huge list that I had to whittle down into ones that were the most interesting to talk about, because there's so many people who just get murdered by other senators in that period.
Yeah, well, it was so interesting to read your book and sort of see them all put together in the way that they have been, because we have been saying how odd it is that there are these murders as part of the foundation myth. We've looked at Lucretia and all of that kind of stuff. But certainly something that we know, because our specialty is much later than the period we're currently studying, is that violence definitely remains a part of the political scene of Rome. It's almost like the Romulus and Remus myth is trying to tell us something about where we're heading. So can you tell us how murder played out within the imperial family? Like, once we get the empire, you know, Julius Caesar's, maybe we should start with Julius Caesar actually and then go into the imperial families, but how does that all play out?
Julius Caesar is kind of the, not really the last, but one of the last of the people murdered in order to quote unquote protect the Republic. So, you know, from the very first time that they had a consul right the way down to Julius Caesar, they were constantly executing people with trials initially. So when you go look back at like the 4th century, 5th century BCE, there's a lot of people who get executed for being too popular in case they wanted to be a king. But once you get down to the historical period, the senators start accusing each other of wanting to be a king, threatening the Republic, and then stabbing each other in the streets or beating each other to death with a stick. And so he's one of the last ones to be executed because he was threatening the Republic. And then Augustus, again, quote unquote, restores the Republic. And what happens is you start to get people being killed in much less public ways because the focus swivels to the family. And like so much of Augustus's plan is to build the family as the center of life. And so you start to get people being murdered or being accused of murdering people in secret behind closed doors, and it's largely women doing it. So immediately you get Livia, and the stories that Tacitus tells about Livia murdering every person that she has ever set eyes on, including while they are not even anywhere near Rome, like things that could not possibly be under any circumstances her fault, where like people getting stabbed in camps in Syria, somehow Livia did it.
Oh, she's got reach, that woman, you know.
I have a really good teacher actually, which is a Mike Duncan one, which has Livia in the middle surrounded by dead bodies, and it says Livia did it. But immediately the story becomes that families are where violence is happening, and mostly it's women, and it's happening in secret. So Livilla killing Drusus, Agrippina and Claudius, and like that's where the story is. Nero and Britannicus, like you could stand here for the next hours. And then that story is about every emperor gets a story that they have been secretly murdered, except Nero, actually, because he kills himself. But everybody else gets a story that, oh, maybe Titus secretly killed Vespasian, or maybe Domitian killed Titus, or maybe Marcus Aurelius killed Lucius Verus. Like, come on, of all the people, Marcus Aurelius. but, so violence becomes a secret thing.
I think at least with Marcus Aurelius, we'd be he'd be feeling kind of bad about it. He'd be thinking through that if he had actually
The story about him actually is really good. It's from the Historia Augusta, so obviously it's nonsense. But this, but it is very kind of Marcus Aurelius clever. So basically he coats one side of a knife with poison, so one side of the blade, and then cuts a sow's uterus when they're eating, and then gives Lucius the side that has the poison on it. So he eats it, but it doesn't have poison on that side of the knife, so he's okay, and then it doesn't look like he did it, you see? Genius.
Very clever.
It'd be great for some kind of, like, Amazon Kindle thriller.
A philosopher emperor, so clever, so wise.
Exactly.
And I must admit, I was quite blown away by the statistics that you compiled about emperors themselves.
Yeah.
How long they ruled for and what the averages were and how they stack up. I mean, it's quite breathtaking to consider that in the early empire, which you put as being from about 27 BC to about 193 BC, the average reign was only 12.7 years per emperor.
Yeah. And that's the good times.
Yeah. And then when you throw in everything else, it gets down to 6 years.
Yeah. They are unusually violent with killing emperors. So many of them die of, like, well over half die of violent means. And it's just really, it's Walter Scheidel's analysis, who put it into a kind of global context where he looked at loads of other ones and was like, there's, like, normal dynasties, like, on average in a global context, are like 300 years. And a normal dynasty for the Romans is 12. Like, 50 years is the best dynasty that they get. And we consider that to be, like, the big ones. And anyone who manages to get, no one manages to get, like, three generations down, really. You manage to, if you get a son to inherit, then that's good. No one gets a grandson.
No, I think my students who study the Julio-Claudians with me would be shocked beyond belief to hear that they're actually the good dynasty.
Yeah, they're the really successful one. They are, yeah, they're a uniquely cursed family as well. But because there's so many of them at the beginning, they're the only ones who manage to survive because they just keep being able to have cousins and nephews and weird uncles who can take the throne when there's nobody else. But when the other families have been thinned out by the time you get to, like, the second century, so whenever someone rises up, they haven't got any big families or cousins or anything that they can then send the throne to. And then they execute everybody who could be a potential threat, which means that when they inevitably get stabbed or poisoned or upset the Praetorian Guard or get overthrown by somebody from Dalmatia, then there's nobody to say, oh, it's okay, I'm going to take the mantle Octavian style, because they thinned out their own family too much. I've always thought, and I've thought this since I was an undergraduate, and even more while I was writing that chapter, like, what the hell attracts you to this job? It looks stressful. Like, sure, you get a really nice toga and a big house briefly, but it looks stressful. You've got to balance the competing interests of three sets of people who are kind of fundamentally opposed to one another in terms of what they want, like the people and the Senate and the army. You're having to be, for, you know, at least the early period, you're having to be an emperor while pretending that you're not an emperor. You're a king, but you have to keep pretending that these 600 lads who come and hang out in a building a couple of times a week have some kind of say in what you do. And any time that you say, well, I'm the emperor, I'm going to do what I want, they get really cross with you and write a horrible poem. and then eventually you'll piss one of them off and they stab you. It sounds like a rubbish job.
This is what Hollywood fails to tell you, that if you become an emperor, it's not just all lying around on couches in fancy clothes eating grapes. You have a 60% chance of being murdered.
Yeah, and if you're not murdered, you have to listen to bloody Stoic philosophers in the Senate wang on for hours.
Yeah, a fate worse than death.
I've always had a certain amount of sympathy with Tiberius retiring to Capri, because it seems like he just had no patience for them, like,
Thank you. Thank you. See, Tiberius is my favorite emperor, so I appreciate
it. I always defend Tiberius because I do feel like, you know, he gets a bad rap from Tacitus and that has upset everybody forever. Then there's those three paragraphs of Suetonius that the only bits that anyone ever remembers. He just wanted to live a life. Like, he just wanted them to get on with making decisions and they kept going, yeah, but what do you want? What do you want? What do you want? What do you want? And he'd be like, can you not just make a decision? Even if I go to Capri, will you not just make a decision? Also, there's a really good story about a senator prostrating himself in front of Tiberius in order to beg him something. Yes. And Tiberius being so horrified that he steps back and trips over his own toga. Which
is one of my favourite stories of all time.
Yeah, same. I love it.
Poor Tiberius.
I know.
So... I'm sorry to interrupt the Tiberius love fest, but I will take that task upon myself as the Augustan.
Oh, okay.
So it seems like from an imperial perspective, things are not great in terms of the murder rate. And obviously this would sort of have an effect on how we think about murder more broadly in society as well. And I'm wondering if you can speak to how murder is happening in sort of like the everyday Roman's life.
See, this is interesting because it's kind of mysterious, but one of the ways I found that you could find murders or people who thought that their loved ones had been murdered was in epigraphy, was when people had, when they had no real recourse to justice, because you can't like go to the police and they're not going to interview people and solve your crime for you. Rome is a self-help society, so if you want justice, you have to get it yourself, and you either have to negotiate it or you have to do a revenge killing, which I feel is probably not strongly encouraged. Or if you can't do those things, then you write it on a bit of stone and erect it. So you get some which are kind of stranger killings. So there's a few of people who were murdered like on the street in the process of robberies, and they don't know who did it, and so you get these kind of really sad little stories. There's a 10-year-old girl who is killed in the process of a robbery, and there's a guy who's killed while traveling because bandits get him. But the one that really intrigued me was the amount of people who think that their family members, their loved ones, have been killed by magic. There's quite a lot of them that appear across the empire. There's a really good one with a guy who puts his entire complicated soap opera love story on his daughter's tomb, because why not make your daughter's death all about you? He freed one of the slaves in his household so that he could marry her. And then pretty much as soon as she was freed, she legged it with another freedman.
So
good work.
Which, fair enough. Shortly after she legged it, his daughter from his previous marriage got ill and started wasting away from something. Like, and nothing that they were doing was making it better. She's like 8 years old, and obviously they're trying Roman medicine, so they're just dunking her in ice baths and rubbing poultices on her. So she's probably just ill and uncomfortable. So she eventually passes, and he puts on her tombstone this whole story that the freedwoman had cursed the daughter, and that her kind of, as she was leaving, she had cursed the daughter, and that's what had killed her. And then he kind of does kind of classic Roman curse text where he wishes that she will also be cursed in her life. And you find these other ones which are like much shorter, but people who are who are believed to have died as a result of curses. The reason that I find this interesting is because what they've probably died of is some kind of disease that the Romans couldn't recognise, like something like jaundice that turned them yellow, or lupus, which gave them a weird shaped rash, or like any kind of disease which has any sort of strange outcome. And what they're going to see is their loved one inexplicably turning purple or having agonies inside their bones that they don't understand. And when they eventually pass away, they are like, well, someone cursed them. Obviously I've cursed a bunch of people, like I wrote about curses on some lead in And so for their worldview, murder isn't just something that happens because someone gets stabbed in the street or beaten to death. Murder is something that can happen very secretly from a distance and probably happens in their concept a lot more often than we think it does, because people who are dying of natural causes are being considered murder victims. There's a whole kind of spiraling out from that, which I find really interesting, of like how then, because some people reckon they know who cursed them, which means that their, you know, their daughter died of, I don't know, lupus or whatever. I always think of lupus because it's such a weird thing from House, and it does look super strange. Somebody in the first century had it, you'd be like, what the fuck? And then you're like, well, she had an argument with, you know, Sarah over there, so she must have cursed her. And now I'm going to get revenge against Sarah. And then you've got a whole family drama happening in some province over someone who technically died of natural causes, but is considered to be murdered. There's a novel in it.
I kind of love that, though, because it gives you this whole way of being able to murder people without having to be physically at the scene of the crime yourself, which really doesn't do wonders for Livia.
It doesn't, poor Olivia. And, you know, and then I love a good curse tablet anyway. It all must have felt very self-reinforcing. You write a curse tablet in order to curse someone who stole your bowl, and then you're also seeing somebody across the road die of some wasting disease, and so they must have been cursed by somebody, which means that curses work. So
it's kind of a weird way of making yourself feel very powerful but also very vulnerable at the same time.
Yeah. I really liked thinking about that, because it's just like a thinking about that worldview just completely shifts slightly how you imagine the Romans lived.
Yeah, well, as you say, I mean, natural diseases in an age without Western modern medicine, however you want to term it, people would have been dying all the time from all sorts of diseases that could not be explained. And it must have been terrifying to think that there's a lot of murder happening.
Yeah, as far as they're concerned, there's people being cursed left, right and centre.
Yeah, and I mean, kind of related to this idea of being cursed, of course, is also this idea of being poisoned, this secret way of killing people. And the most famous example, naturally, is Germanicus.
Yep.
Prince of our hearts.
Yeah.
Yes. The princess Diana of his day.
He is the Princess Diana of his day. Died too soon and therefore could never do any wrong. Yes. He's killed from afar, which means that you can kind of project whatever information that you want to onto it. I was actually rereading this with Tacitus the other day. It's really interesting the way that he writes about it, because I think that he doesn't believe that Germanicus was murdered, and he thinks that people who think he was are idiots.
I agree. He wants to slam Tiberius at the same time.
Yeah, he does, and he really wants the story to be true, but I don't think he believes it. So he writes it in a really smart way, because Tacitus, for all his many faults, is a great writer, whereby he puts all of the accusations in other people's mouths, and also really emphasizes the fact that false information comes to Rome. So he has this bit where the news that Germanicus has died comes to Rome, and then the news comes that he's alive, and then more news comes that he's dead. And everyone is confused. But basically the deal is that people believe, and Germanicus apparently himself believed, and certainly Agrippina believed, that this is where magic and poison cross over as well.
Yes.
That Piso had cursed and or poisoned Germanicus in Syria, because they're having an argument over who controlled Syria, basically. And on the one hand, you have this story that they find in Germanicus's house all of these curse tablets and things with his name written on them, with nails driven through them, and bits of human bodies. And
ew.
Bloody ashes is my favourite, because it's ashes. The blood is not... Where are you getting the blood from? Did the blood come from someone else? I don't... But bloodied
it really
ashes...
It sounds like a haunted house. It really sounds like a haunted house.
And someone has, like, snuck these into the walls of his house in Syria. Then Suetonius has this bit about when they cremated his body, his heart didn't burn, which was proof of poison, which I'm sure is definitely medically accepted.
Naturally.
Yeah. It's what happens with poisons. They just stop your heart from burning. So there's that story. But then when you get to the trial part, what he's accused of is putting poison in Germanicus's dinner, which is a different thing to cursing him. But that overlap between, and the same word is used quite often for magic and murder and poison. And a lot of times when people are attempting magic, they will also, you know, stick something poisonous into their tea. But that's a really interesting overlap that makes it difficult to tangle, like untangle, basically, because then when somebody says magic, do they actually mean put arsenic in their tea? Or do they mean putting bloodied ashes in their walls?
Yeah. And contextually, this story is just so difficult to unravel, because for those listeners who aren't familiar, which, I mean, by now I don't know how you couldn't be, because we've talked about Tiberius a lot.
But have we talked about Germanicus?
Well, this is the thing. So Germanicus is Tiberius's adopted son.
Yeah.
The son of his beloved brother who died in tragic circumstances, because we all know that Tiberius' life is a country song. And even though you would think that makes Germanicus very dear to Tiberius, it seems that personality-wise they are polar opposites and therefore just don't get along, and there's always this kind of tension between them. And maybe Tiberius is a little bitter about having to adopt Germanicus at Augustus's request over his own biological son by the wife that he adored. Who knows? There's definitely some tension in the imperial household. And so when Germanicus dies suddenly in these very weird circumstances, which you're highlighting, is it poison? Is it cursing? And the person involved, Piso, seems to be very good friends with Tiberius, and his wife is very good friends with Tiberius's mother, Livia. It all gets even more suspicious, even though, of course, this would mean that Livia would have to be murdering her own grandchild.
Yep, from a distance.
Amazing.
And also Piso,
from a distance.
Just to make things worse for himself, when Germanicus dies, he is like hovering around just outside of Syria, and then he goes back as soon as he's heard that Germanicus is dead and sort of raises an army and technically commits treason. And then as soon as another army turns up and says, what are you doing? He goes, oh God, sorry. And goes back to Rome. But technically he does spend about 2 weeks committing treason. And then he goes back to Rome and is put on trial, and then he kills himself. But his wife gets a pardon from Livia, which just makes the whole thing 10,000% more suspicious.
Absolutely. And there was of course also an actual poisoner mentioned in connection with
Martina.
This case, wasn't there?
Martina, whose death makes absolutely no sense, because it's like she dies, she's sent from Syria to Rome, presumably to stand trial, and then she dies as soon as they hit Italian soil. And Tacitus is like, oh, there didn't seem to be any unnatural causes, but she had poison hidden in a knot of her hair. Which is, I don't know, it's something that I think about a lot. Like, what was her hair doing? How did she get, is it like a bun and then she's got poison in there? That is in her hair. It's not going to kill her from her hair. Like, what does it mean?
Well, presumably the Romans didn't have cavity searches, so I don't know why it had to be in her hair.
She could just put it in a pocket. But then she obviously didn't take it anyway. But she dies also under mysterious circumstances, which is bad news for Piso. And poor old Piso has to kill himself. And that's when Tacitus even gets really into Tiberius, because he's like, oh, there were my contemporaries of the time, like my father's companions have told me that they saw Piso with a bit of paper that he would have brought out in court, except Tiberius told him not to, and da, 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 da. It's a good conspiracy.
Absolutely. And the other story that sort of jumped out at me from this sort of general discussion of, you know, magic and all these sort of weird ways that murder worked in the Roman world is just how easily you could be accused of murder. apparently, yeah. Owning an ugly statue or owning a mirror.
Owning a mirror. And like buying a suspicious fish. Yeah, so this is Apuleius, who we know because he wrote the Metamorphoses, which is a really great text about a guy who gets turned into a donkey and then is stolen before he can be turned back, and then has adventures going across the empire as a donkey, including a bit where they try to get him into a live sex show. A bit that is like, you know, you have those memories that are just burnt into you. And I remember being an undergraduate and reading this in the library and just being like, why has nobody told me about this before? And then just having to walk around the library finding my friends being like, is this a live sex show? But he has all these adventures going around. But this is, so that's his kind of great work. But he was a poet as well, and he had spent his life meandering around the empire. And he had an interesting situation where he rolled up in North Africa to visit a friend of his from school in Alexandria, and ended up marrying his friend's mum. As you do. And she is a kind of the rich widow of the town. And this upsets her previous husband's brother and his family, because they were hoping that they would inherit all of her money, basically. And now she has a husband and it's not going to go the way that they want it to. So then Apuleius' friend from school dies. He dies on a boat nowhere near where they're living, but still, this is suspicious enough that they managed to pull him into court. There's quite a good bit in Apuleius' speech where he says that they spent like months meeting each other in the baths and having like, oh yeah, what are you going to do about it kind of arguments. And eventually they take him to court and accuse him of murder and also tricking the widow into marrying him through magic. They eventually drop the murder charge because it happened so far away they can't really prove it, but they then are just like, he's a magician who is manipulating people around him. And the things that they come up with are that he bought this statue that they think is ugly, that he was seen buying fish, that he owns a mirror that is definitely being used for something suspicious. There's a thing about him using an enslaved boy in rituals, which no one can describe, but like they're all such innocuous things. And when he writes poetry, that's also deeply suspicious.
Well, I was going to say.
He does manage to use the fact that they've turned his poetry into an accusation, into making his own trial, his open mic night. So he reads several of his own poems. Which is exactly what you can expect from poets. But they're such innocuous and everyday things that you can't deny owning the ugly statue. And thankfully for Apuleius, he seems to know quite a lot about magical stuff. And he's a trained orator, he's a trained rhetorician, so he can dismantle the arguments quite well. So he goes through them one by one, and then he's so pleased with himself he publishes the speech, which is useful for us. But he goes through them one by one and is like, look, my poems are about toothpaste. Here's my poem about toothpaste. Yes, I own an ugly statue, but here is why I own the ugly statue. You know, there's various reasons for owning a mirror, and goes and is able to dismantle them in such a way that he, as far as we can tell, is found innocent. But for anyone else, it would be, you're hauled into court by surprise, because they do get him by surprise. You're accused of owning a mirror. And if you did that to me, I'd be like, yeah. But I do it because I do my eyebrows. And I would probably end up being executed for using magic. And that potentially happened quite a lot, because they're such unanswerable accusations. Like, how do you say, it's just an ugly statue?
I just have bad taste. What can I say?
Yeah, I just really, really like the ugly statue. What are you saying? It's ugly. But again, it's such a way in which really everyday things can be cast as magical, and which makes the world a magical world that they are living in, and a way that innocuous deaths can be seen as murder, even when they are not, and how that can be used to people's advantage. Because something else I really got interested in was denouncers, professional denouncers.
Yes.
And how they use bad emperors to murder their enemies.
Yes, which is quite terrifying. I mean, it's definitely something that, as a fan of Tiberius, to see as an enemy of Tiberius, we're very familiar with the whole informing thing, because it becomes such a big feature of his reign in the source material. But yes, this idea that you could be accused by someone just because they want to get their hands on your property, out of this false show of loyalty, and you could end up executed for that. It's crazy.
Or they could be doing it to get revenge on something. So there's one under Nero where he accuses the guy who had his father executed of having a surname that is offensive to Nero. And he's like, well, yeah, that is my surname. And they're like, well, it's offensive. And so he is Nero is in Greece at the time, so he didn't really have anything to do with it, but they execute him for it. So they just execute this guy for having a surname. Like, he's been living with the surname his whole life. His dad's got it, his son's got it, everyone's got it. But all of a sudden, this one guy comes out of nowhere, accuses him of being an offence, like, in his being, and then he's executed, and thus revenge is had. Like, this can happen, and it can be a way of using the emperor's willingness to execute anyone who seems to be a threat in literally any way to get your own revenges in a perfectly legal way.
Yes, and you've highlighted how much that it's kind of the insecure emperors that tend to be able to be taken advantage of in this way or used in this way. People like Augustus, I am sorry to say, so full of self-confidence and charisma that they don't fall prey to these sort of delatores.
It's true. It's interesting that it is usually the ones who inherit the throne. It's the Nero and the Domitian and the Tiberius. It's not the ones who fight their way to the throne, basically. It is the ones who feel that they need to prove that they belong, or that they feel insecure in their position in some way, and that they need to force people to accept them.
This explains why these dynasties end up being so short. Yeah. Because as you go down the generations, they just become more and more insecure.
Hugely insecure. And as a general rule, like, a son inherits, is wildly insecure, and gets murdered 10 years later. Then the whole cycle starts again. But it's, what was interesting to me was less the emperors, but how people around them, so how your average senator or your average litigator could see the insecurities of the emperor, could see the state of play in their world and go, I can use that. And then when basically retires from informing during Vespasian and Titus's reign and does other stuff, but then as soon as Domitian takes the throne, he's back being like, that guy said something bad about you. And, like, obviously he is a very careful, very savvy person who knows how to play the political landscape that he's in for his own benefit and does really well at it. And I find that part of it interesting, the way that people use the world they live in order to kill other people.
I think this leads us really nicely, actually, into this concept of slavery, which we haven't yet touched on, but which permeates the Roman world so fundamentally.
Because we're really talking about which lives matter, aren't we? It's the senators write about the delatores and people who use the courts to get revenge or to get property or anything, because it's about those people who they're executing are rich people just like them who are meant to matter in this world. And slaves, on the other hand, are a totally different case, and their murder is also considered in very different terms.
Murder is considered to be property damage. What you get is when people write about crime in the ancient world, they tend to call this thing called the Lex Aquila, the first murder law, because it deals with killing slaves and obviously the very deliberate killing of enslaved people and all of the many, many ways in which you can kill an enslaved person. But what it is a property damage law. And in among, like, you pick those ones out because they are horrible. It's like, if you beat this person to death, or if some other guy happens to throw your slave off of a cliff, then you have to pay X amount. But they also deals with, like, oh, if somebody kills your sheep, if somebody kills your cow, what is a beast? It's slaves and beasts of burden, which is means that they are considering them to be the same as a cow or a goat or a sheep, like, not a person. This isn't some to deal with taking human life. It's to do with who gets compensated and who has to do the compensating if something that you own gets killed, and it's something, not someone. And any time that an enslaved person gets killed, that's what it's talking about. It's talking about who owns this property, what is the property worth, and who has to pay and how much. So the case that gets brought up a lot is one of Cicero's ones, where a guy is killed. He's an enslaved actor who's being trained to be an actor, and was bought in conjunction with two people. So they jointly own him, and they were investing in him in order to make him an actor. And one of them kills him, and the other guy says, you owe me the money for the slave that we had. And the argument is, does the murderer or killer owe how much they paid for the guy, or do they owe how much he was now worth if they had sold him when he died? Because now he has skills that he didn't have. So they paid 50 quid, but they could now sell him for 1,000. And no point is anyone like, you killed a guy. Like, a man was alive and had feelings and was, you know, we know nothing about him. We don't know.
And also, those feelings were being trained for the stage. I'm like, this was somebody in touch with their emotional core in order to be good at this job.
Exactly. And then you, for reasons that are completely not, like, nobody goes into why you did it. They're like, yeah, you killed him. Like, you're a literal murderer. But the only thing that they're worried about is how much is he worth? And Cicero goes on and is like, oh, well, his body doesn't matter. What matters is his skills.
Thanks, Cicero. Another reason to dislike you.
Yet another reason to never want to hang out with you. Yeah, and like the casualness of how they just instinctively don't consider this to be a person that they're talking about. They're talking about a property damage case. It's as if somebody, as if he'd hurt his favourite vase. They would be having the exact same argument if he had killed his horse, who was particularly good at breeding racing horses. Like, there's nothing there that they suggest they're talking about people. And then the casualness of violence against enslaved people is just, when you start looking at it, is just wild. And there's a story in A Letter of Pliny, which he tells is a really funny story. A senator, a magistrate, go into a public baths, and his enslaved attendant like touches someone's arm to move them out of the way, because that's what they do. And the guy that he's moving turns around to just and throws a punch. Like, his immediate reaction to being touched, assuming that he's being touched by a slave, is to punch him. And he misses and hits the senator. Just a square in the face hits the senator. Which Pliny thinks is a hilarious story. It is quite funny. At the core of it is the fact that this guy, when touched by someone that he thought was worthless, his immediate reaction was just to violently go for him. And if he had hit the guy he was meaning to hit, that story would never have been. That's just an average everyday thing that apparently happens, where people become furious and punch people. And then, I don't know, what does this guy just step over? The everyday nature of violence against slaves. And you have to do something genuinely horrific. You have to do something really terrible to get into the history books for being bad to enslaved people. And the story that people screenshot a lot and send to me from the book is the one with where Augustus is having dinner at a friend's house, and one of the enslaved attendants drops a piece of glassware and breaks it. And so the homeowner, in order to impress Augustus, says, execute him. And had he been executed in a normal way, like crucified or just beaten to death, or however one kills a slave, this would just be, again, an incident which occurred, and God knows how often these incidents occurred in everyday life. But he has a very special way of killing his enslaved people, which is he has a tank of lampreys. And I googled a lamprey, because in my imagination prior to this, lampreys were about 6 inches long and like little eels. And it turns out that they're like a meter long. They're ginormous. They are older than dinosaurs, because they evolved to be perfect evil and then never needed to evolve again. And what they have is, they're basically, their entire face is a mouth, like a sucky mouth, which is like concentric circles of teeth going all the way down their throat. So you can just see down it all the time. And they latch onto their prey and then suck and gnaw at the same time. And it's a very slow process of death, and a very, very painful process of death, and upsets a lot of readers. So, but I have got really good at drawing lampreys, because I draw them on people's books. But this is such a monstrous thing that Augustus teenage warlord Augustus is like, whoa, no, and stops it and frees the guy instead because he's Augustus, so he can do that. But that is like the left.
That's points for Augustus right there.
But that's like the level of horror that you have to reach. And also Augustus has to be there, because this wouldn't be there if anybody else was interested. It might go into a letter, but it's not going to be on that. In order for violence against slaves to be worthy of talking about. But the rest of the time, like technically, up until Hadrian, I think, you can just send a slave to be killed in the arena for any reason. And there's no checks or balances on that. Like, you can just be like, you don't like you anymore. You're going to go and be eaten by a lion. And then Hadrian says you have to have a magistrate's permission, which means that there are now people going to the magistrate saying, I don't like him. or he did X, Y, Z. I want him to be mauled to death by a bear. And you don't even have to take responsibility for killing them. And there, it's not until Constantine that he says you can't kill your slaves anymore, which is late as hell. And then he goes into loads of detail in a manner that suggests he's enjoying writing about it. So you can't beat them, you can't set them on fire, you can't... He says you can kill them accidentally if you happen to beat them to death, but you didn't mean to beat them to death, that's okay.
Now that sounds like a loophole if ever I've heard
It's one hell of a loophole. Like, I set him on fire, but I didn't mean to kill him. And yeah, there's like a lot of ways that he goes through. Like, you can't throw them off of stuff, you can't hang them, you can't crucify them, you can't, that again suggests that he's gone through and thought about like, what are the things that I've seen recently that I don't need, like that I don't need people to stop doing, and they're horrible. Like, and what slavery is underpins everything. Like, Rome can exist because of slavery. The millions of lives that were chewed up by Roman slavery, both in the city and in the empire at large, is just a yawning abyss of horror to think about. Millions of them. And their lives were treated as though they were the same as a table. And that really kind of underpins how they see everything. Because if this person isn't a person, then what makes a person? And what makes a person is what you offer to the state. So what people think of you and what honours you have, essentially. And the more family you have, the more you offer in terms of having prestige and having honours, having citizenship, the more your life is worth. So if you're a consul with triumphal regalia, then, and someone kills you, then that's going to be a big deal. Like, that's an attack on the state, effectively. If you are Joe Bloggs in the street and you get killed, well, yeah, there's loads of Joe Bloggs in the street. And that is what life is worth, basically, in Rome.
Yeah, and the interesting case that you highlighted, it kind of connects to that, is the case of Apronia, who mysteriously fell, was pushed out of her bedroom window a couple of floors up. And I particularly like this story because you highlighted that the reason why anyone pays attention to this is because she's related to men of this high class who cause a huge stink about it and demand that something be done. And I particularly wanted to highlight this case because, Dr. G, Tiberius goes and checks out the crime scene.
Oh, yeah. This is a very special case indeed. Having an emperor check in, being like, I'll be the detective. I've got this.
I like, he goes like full Poirot on the situation. And there's another reason why I like Tiberius, because whenever someone comes to him with something, he's like, that sounds very interesting. I would like to investigate this. and he does it when people come to him like, we found some giant bones. And he's like, interesting. But so what happens is Apronia, who is the daughter of a consul with triumphal regalia, as it happens, is found one morning having dropped out of her window a few floors up and died. And her father, her husband, is like, oh, she must have jumped out the window while I was asleep. How weird. And her father's like, no. And he is one of the most powerful men in Rome. He has access to Tiberius. He goes to Tiberius and says, look, no, that didn't happen. her husband's answer is incoherent, according to Tacitus. So Tiberius goes to have a look at the crime scene, the one and only time that we know of that anyone went to go and have a look at a crime scene. And he goes into the bedroom and finds evidence of force used and resistance put up, which suggests that it was in disarray, and also nobody bothered to tidy up because nobody thought that anyone would be coming around to have a look.
Crime scenes.
Exactly. And so they put him on trial. They find him guilty. But he obviously did not expect that to happen. He assumed that everybody would go, oh, all right, and believe him. Or if anybody did, then nobody was going to come around and have a wee look. And this whole thing gets massively blown up. Interestingly, there is a theory that this is related to a case related to Claudius's wife, and the reason why Claudius, who is the husband's sister, and Claudius,
Claudia, isn't yeah. it? Yeah.
So
yeah.
he divorced her for reasons relating to a murder, and also refused to acknowledge the child that she was carrying at the time. And she is this guy's sister, and there is potential that they were involved in a case involving child sexual abuse of Apronia's son, which comes up in a 5th century Christian text, but is a very, very similar name. And so then you have this whole thing of, like, this family is falling apart over a child sexual abuse case. He murders his wife over it. His sister is implicated in this murder and also in the assault. And as a result, Claudius has to divorce her in order to get away with it. Such a good scandal.
They sound like an absolutely appalling family. And I'm glad Tiberius went Miss Marple on their ass.
He really did. And then he found everybody guilty. But just because patriarchy is always there, Plautus' friends say that he would never do this. He's such a nice guy. I can't believe you'd say this. And if he did do it, then it must be his previous wife's fault because she put a magic curse on him. And they drag this innocent woman who was previously married to this woman murderer, drag her into court and accuse her of being a magician.
Oh my goodness. All these cases, as much as there are hilarious elements to them, they do kind of highlight that if you were a woman or a slave or someone without a huge voice in this society, that you really were kind of screwed probably 99% of the time. And of course, if you were a slave and you decided you were going to, say, murder your master rather than be murdered by them, mm-hmm. Now that was a truly dangerous path to go down.
It really was, because the law in Rome was that if a master was murdered by one of their slaves, every single slave in the household had to be crucified. So
ouch.
If you murder your master, you are not only condemning yourself to death, like, you might say, you know, I'll take that bullet and free everybody from this guy. Everybody else in that household was dying with you. And there is a very notorious case under Nero where a guy is murdered by one of his enslaved attendants, and he has 400 slaves in his household, women and children and entire families, and each and every one of them has to be executed. And it's such a drastic thing that the Senate debates it, because the people of Rome are disgusted that this many people are going to be killed for the actions of one. Like, that's their line, apparently. And they riot over it. And so the Senate have a conversation, and they are very, very honest about why they do it, which is there's loads of them in comparison to us. In our households, there's 400 of them and one of me. And if we don't do this, if we don't make them live in terror every minute, then they could kill us at any time. You see both the division in class and how they see the world, which is that the senators are looking at this case as that could happen to me and I could be the dead guy. And I don't need the people that put my toga on and the people that brush my hair and the people that bathe me and make my food and do literally everything for me to think that they can kill me. I need them to be terrified every minute. And the people of Rome, who are not surrounded by slaves and who put their own shoes on, are thinking, fucking hell, that's a lot of people. And are not considering it from the same perspective at all. They're thinking 400 people are going to be nailed up, including children, outside of our city gate. eventually, obviously, the Senate decide that they have to go through with it because their concerns are more important than anybody else's.
Big surprise. Right? Yeah.
So the compromise that they make is that originally they were also going to kill all of the freed people in the household. So all of the former slaves, which is wild because you're like, you free, like, technically I'm a free person. Like, why am I, you can't just execute me for no reason.
Oh no, you're not a free person though. You're a freed person. And that distinction is mm-hmm. very important to the Romans.
So they compromise and say they won't do that, but all of the enslaved people have to go. The first attempt, the people of Rome throw rocks at them, so they have to back off. And then they have to get the army in to escort all of these people to their deaths for the second time. And they are all nailed up. And it's interesting how clear the kind of the senatorial arguments are as to why they're doing it, which is literally, I'm more important than they are. I am fundamentally more important than those 400 people and any slave in this city. I am more important. Therefore, they all need to die to protect me.
The one thing about the Romans is that they make no attempt to hide the fact that their society is highly stratified into those who matter and those who don't.
They are very, very, they are quite proud of it. They will literally say, like, well, you need fama in order to be important and we don't care otherwise. Which I consider to be remarkably honest, because in our world we have laws which say if you murder someone, I mean, they're very, very clear, like, this is murder. There's, like, in English law, there's like 6 criteria that you have to meet in order for something to be considered murder. And they're very clear, like, anyone who does these 6 things is a murderer. But if you are a sex worker, then and someone does these things to you, then, well, I mean, were you asking for it by being a sex worker? And if you are not considered to be important, basically, then the wheels of justice are going to turn considerably more slowly for you. And there are secret, hidden, known but not spoken of reasons why you might not be important to the police. Like, you're a girl, you're not white, you're not from a nice family, you're... I don't know if you watched the Yorkshire Ripper documentary that's on Netflix.
Did I?
But, like, so much of the initial response to it is just, oh, well, there were sex workers. And it's not until a 16-year-old girl was killed from a nice middle-class home that the Yorkshire police were like, oh, this is people that we know. We should probably do something about this. And, like, it's just secret and unknown. And that almost feels kind of worse to me, because at least in Roman Empire, like, if I am, I would be a person who's walking around Joe Bloggs on the street worth nothing. And I know if I get killed, like, no one's going to come. And if somebody, like, if you don't expect anything, you can't be disappointed. Whereas in the world we live in, I kind of would like to think that if I got murdered, or if somebody that I love got murdered, the fact that they're a sex worker wouldn't matter. Or the fact that they're not white wouldn't matter. And I would expect some justice to move, but then I'm going to be super disappointed when it doesn't and I have to fight. And, like, so much rage that you see in true crime stuff amongst victim families and survivors is like, why won't it, would the wheels of justice turn for me? Why did it have to wait until that happened for it? Whereas in the Roman world, you just wouldn't expect that there are no wheels of justice for you. So you can't be disappointed when the system offers you nothing.
I feel like this might be actually maybe a good point to sort of wrap up some of these things. And we're starting to touch on this idea already, like, how does the Roman way of looking at murder differ from the way that we look at murder today? And to speak to this idea that you've started to touch on, even in the context of Sydney, Australia, and this might be news for the world, but I'm going to give it a whirl anyway. In about 2014, there was some violence in the inner city, and a man punched another man, and the victim of that punch died. And the response to this was massive. They basically shut down all of the nightlife in the city, and it has only been reopened around about the time that COVID began to take off. And so it took a good sort of 6 years of those lockdown laws, which were really quite severe, decimated the nightlife, decimated business, to sort of be retracted a little bit from where they were. And yet violence against women in Australia, women we know are murdered at a rate of about one a week. So the nature of the violence that can happen in a society and the way society tells you what kind of murder is important or what kind of killing is important, what's significant, really starts to shine through even when you start to look at contemporary examples as well. And so seeing how the Roman world is playing that out and the way that society today is playing that out, I think is a fascinating point of interconnection that we can start to build a relationship with that history by comparing how we think about these things today as well.
Yeah, and what you see in the Roman world is that murder is something which matters when it happens to a man. If a woman is murdered, it's not that she has been murdered, it is that her family has been hurt by it. And it will be her, you know, her brother, her father will has been hurt and he will have to do something about it. And the arguments will often be that he has been damaged in some way rather than like the... It's hard to wrap your head around because we have a very inherent, I think, our generation, at least kind of post-war Western world, that individual life is worthy of something just because it is. Like, we have a human rights perspective on the world which says a person is a person and they deserve to be alive. The Romans just did not have that. He needed to hurt something in order to matter. And so the case of Regilla, who is murdered by her husband, who is a very, very famous philosopher called Herodes Atticus, who built the big theatre, which is on the side of the Acropolis, in her memory after he beat her to death. he is taken to court by her brother for murdering her. And her brother's argument from beginning to end is, I am a patrician, I come from a patrician family, I've got patrician shoes, basically lists off all of their ancestors for ages, and then ends with saying, and he killed my sister, he can't be allowed to get away with this. And like, that's the whole argument. And Herodes Atticus, the brother is not very smart by any stretch of the imagination. Herodes Atticus comes forward and said, well, yeah, she's dead. And yeah, I did order her killing, but technically I didn't do the kicking, so I'm innocent at the end. And they let him off because he gets a slave to kill her. He orders one of his enslaved attendants to kick her to death while she's pregnant. From her brother's perspective, it's not that he's killed his sister necessarily, it's that he has dared. He has this Greek upstart has dared to injure his patrician ancient family. That was a member of his family. She was related to all of these consuls and generals and people with half moons on their shoes. And he has dared to damage that, basically. And that is what you are damaging when you are damaging a person. You're damaging what they mean to the rest of the world, and specifically to upper class men. And if you don't mean anything to upper class men, then you don't mean anything to anyone as far as history is concerned.
Yeah, I think that's the big takeaway of like the big difference that I noticed when I was reading your book was something that I knew, but I think it just was highlighted when I sort of all came together in your book, was basically this idea that if someone didn't make a huge fuss, that murder could be something that was kept quite private within the family to maintain the good family name, keep the status quo, that this could be something that, say, in a case of domestic violence, it could be hushed up and it could be something that's completely forgotten by history. Or if we're talking about things like infanticide, which are, as you highlighted, incredibly difficult to trace the history of, but it could be something that was actually quite private, whereas we think of murder as something, you know, that yeah, the public has a right to know and we need to investigate because there's a state that yeah, needs to investigate this crime.
Yeah, and that is like the real difficulty as a historian, but interesting part is how private things that we think of as being very, very public were, and how central the family was to dealing with these matters. So there's like two or three cases of domestic murder, like men murdering their wives and vice versa. And we only know about them. One is an epitaph, a really long epitaph. It's another one where you're a bit like, what dirty laundry in public, putting your soap opera on stone forever, but sure. Thank you for doing that. I really appreciate it, actually. but we only know about them because someone famous made a fuss, or they related to somebody famous, or they involved the emperor doing something weird in a way that made everybody talk about it. And 99.999% of these cases are dealt with by the paterfamilias, or the family getting together, talking to the other family, having a conversation about it, and working out restitution in their own time. And infanticide is a thing which is so difficult to consider, because all you have is bones. Like, you don't know how they died, you don't know when they died. At some point, a babe in the first days of its life, a baby died, and there's absolutely no way of knowing how or why. And people can spin out whatever they like out of it, and they do regularly, but it is a private thing that happens in the family. Having a baby is something that happens amongst people in their home behind their walls, and is not anybody else's business until that kid comes of age, basically. Things that happen in public in Rome happen very, very publicly, and are everybody's business, and happen on big stages. But most of what happens in Rome involving murder happens behind closed doors, because most murder is domestic. And that is not particularly interesting to the people who write Roman history, because they don't care about domestic things unless it involves the emperor.
And that's probably time for one final type of death that we haven't talked about, one final type of murder, and that is, of course, that the Romans were big believers in capital punishment.
Yes.
What we would call capital punishment. Can you very quickly tell us about murder carried out by the state?
Yeah, they loved it. They did it constantly. There was their major form of punishment. They had fines, and they had killing people. And they did it for all kinds of reasons and all the time. And it is... So it's another one of those areas where it's a bit overwhelming, actually, when you think about it. We tend to think a lot about the ones that were done in the arena for public spectacle. Those are the ones that get talked about the most, because the idea is so completely alien that you would set someone on fire in the middle of a theatre and have everybody sitting around clapping. Yeah. And the fact that basically, in order to maintain interest in that over the centuries, the Romans got really into staging deaths, in like staging a mythical scene which ends with the death of somebody, like the literal death of somebody. And there's all kind of like martial poems on the opening of the Colosseum include all of these really magnificent scenes that were staged with secret openings in the floor and big bulls being built and like actual stagecraft occurring that end in a criminal who God knows what they did or who they were being eaten or mauled or raped to death by a bull. And those are the ones that tend to draw a lot of attention, because obviously they're wild. And they say something deeply strange about the fact that there were people whose jobs it was to think this up and then like put it on. And that the centre of that is a killing, which was the least important part of it, basically. Like, the important part was developing the narrative tension around the death, because the death was no longer exciting enough. But all alongside that were the everyday executions which occurred, of people being beheaded, people being crucified, which they did specifically at the busiest sites, so the crossroads and places where the most people would see them, which is a very, really horrible thing to do. And people being just kind of generally executed. So there's an inscription from Italy, which is an advert for slave execution services, whereby a local undertaker will also crucify your slave for you for the bargain price of one denarii per attendant, plus costs of materials. And there is an advert for some games which go on for 5 days in Italy, and 3 days of that, no, I think it's one day, one full day of that is just executions from morning to night. Not fun ones, just beheadings, people being like boringly killed by boring methods. This is like their primary way of dealing with things that upset them is executing people. And they put it in the most public of arenas. They put it literally in the arena as a show, or they put it at the crossroads so that everybody knows what has happened. Because so much of Roman power, and Rome as a city and then as an emperor, is like from the very beginning just wants to exert power over everyone around it. Like from Romulus killing Remus, it is, if you hurt Rome in any way, we'll kill you. Like, our immediate response is death. And then they absorb so much of the rest of the world into Rome and then say, oh, if you hurt Rome, we'll kill you. And that is just so fundamental to their way of life and their worldview that it's kind of, as I say, it's kind of overwhelming. Like, the amount of death and murder by the state and murder by one another that kind of permeated everyday life.
Well, Dr. G was very excited that you included the vessels in that final chapter.
Horribly buried alive.
And by all reports, completely innocent.
Completely innocent, yes. I suspect that a lot of them were. There is, I'm doing a thing on Vestal Virgins at the moment, actually, and like the weird pressures of being a Vestal Virgin and how...
How does one control one's urges?
How does one control one's urges? And also, like, the thing with Vestal Virgins that always throws me is, like, they're so young, and so many of the ones that were buried alive, like, in the early kind of Republic, anytime something bad happened, they'd be like, there was a really bad thunderstorm. So right now you've got torrential rain in Sydney. They'd be like, there is torrential rain occurring. There is flooding. Something is bad. Gods are obviously angry. Gonna have some sacrifices to have a check. Gods are definitely angry in these livers. What's happened? Must be a Vestal Virgin. Pick a Vestal Virgin and execute her. and these poor girls, like 19-year-old girls or whatever, just being like, hang on, what? What happened?
Excuse me. Yeah.
Sorry, what? And like, yeah, you could just be, that's their, we'll just execute her. And that is effectively human sacrifice. The Romans would never call it that because they claimed to hate human sacrifice despite regularly doing human sacrifices. But that is effectively a human sacrifice, that you, something bad happens or a Vestal is defiled in some way, so you have to offer her up alive to the gods in order to appease them and get their favour back.
Well, yeah. For them, I mean, it's very important that they don't actually wield
yes,
any weapons.
They don't actually do the sacrificing. They just bury her alive.
Yes, the sacrifice is made by Vesta in some way, underground in the dark.
See, this is why I love the Romans so much, is that they have such complicated ways of thinking about things that always make them the good guys, even though they plainly are not. And they just, like, the way that they think about the world is so fascinating.
Well, I think that's probably a good point to start wrapping up. But before we let you go, even though you've given us so much of your time already, we both so enjoyed reading your book. And one of the things that we really liked about it was that it was scholarly, but also really accessible. So we were wondering before you go, if you could just comment on how you go about writing these books, where you're trying to maintain sort of academic standards, but you're also trying to make it accessible and interesting for the average reader.
Basically, I write for myself. I write the book that I want to read about the whatever I'm writing about. So I find history very funny, and I find the Romans very funny, largely because they take themselves very seriously and also do weird stuff. So if I find something funny, I just write about it the way I see it. But at the same time, I think it's really important not... what I want to do is have readers get how complicated Roman history is and how multi-layered it is and how a lot of these problems are knotty and unsolvable. And so many popular history books that I read will say, you know, the Romans did Y or the Romans thought X, and then they'll give you three examples of that which come from 400 years apart in history. And one of them is the older Seneca's hypotheticals. Like, and you're like, well, like, context. And I don't want, as much as is possible, like, I have to sometimes, so that it doesn't get boring, but as much as possible, I want readers to enjoy that the Romans are fun and weird and horrible, but also that Roman history is fun and weird and horrible and difficult, and that's kind of what makes it fun. That's my aim, and I try to balance those two things so that at no point is it too scholarly. And that's quite easy because obviously academic writing, and if you're writing for academic audiences, you have to try to cover every possible base and like try to think up all of the ways in which somebody will come and tell you that you're an idiot. So it's quite easy to avoid doing that, but also to avoid going into writing effectively fiction about the Romans, and just saying like how we know this stuff and why we know this stuff and where we know it from and what its strange little context is. That's fun to me as well. And it's fun that like some things survived in really weird ways, and or that we only have three quotes which say this, but weirdly they do all say the same thing. Or so I just try to write the book that I want to read, basically.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us as well.
Entirely my
pleasure. We really enjoyed this book. It was a fantastic, I'd say a rip-roaring read, and I'd recommend it to anybody who's got an interest in Roman history and is looking to dive into the weird and wonderful world of all things Roman. So thank you so much for writing it and for sitting down to chat with us about it as well.
It's always my pleasure to chat to you and to talk about the Romans anytime.
So listeners, make sure you go out and grab yourself a copy of A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
Excellent title, by the way.
It is a really good title. I can't take credit for it, unfortunately. My friend Sarah came up with
you
it.
You can also listen out for more Dr. Emma Southern on her own podcast, History is Sexy.
Where we answer people's history questions that they don't want to Google themselves or don't trust Google because Google lies all the time.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. And we look forward to speaking to you on the release of another fascinating tome on Roman history.